Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Liz Corey.
And I'm Katie King.
And this is
True Crime New England.
What's up, everybody?
Hello, welcome back to another episode.
Thank you for joining us. We are always, always, always happy to have you joining us on our episodes of True Crime New England. Katie, what's up?
Liz.
Not a whole lot.
That's good.
Yeah, just kind of living life.
Great.
No plans on poisoning anyone soon?
No official plan. No. Just kidding. No, absolutely not.
Okay, good.
What about you?
Not concrete plans. So no. Officially on the record, no.
Great answer. Great answer.
We were just thinking, you and I, Katie, because today, as you guys can tell by the title, The Derby Poisoner, we were just talking about the cases we've covered and all the female killers that we've talked about. And I think ultimately what we landed on, without going through every single case we've covered, I think you were right in saying this is the second female serial killer we've ever covered. And we might be wrong. And you guys can fact check us on ourselves, but I'm pretty sure the only other serial killer we've covered that was female was Sheila LaBar.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And of course, we've covered female perpetrators.
Oh, yeah.
Who have, by definition, killed more than three people. But I think that the circumstances around those were a little different, where you could not really effectively argue that they were serial killers.
No.
I mean, one of them murdered a bunch of her children, but it was more so postpartum psychosis. I really would not classify her as a serial killer.
No, not at all.
And then there was another woman we covered who was more so like a shooting spree, but they were all related and she was really upset and disgruntled. And I mean, I really wouldn't call that a serial killing either, no. I don't think.
More a spree killing.
Yes.
And a lot of, we were kind of going over like, oh, serial killers a lot of the time are killing via opportunity, while, you know, the cases we've covered, postpartum psychosis, you know, we were talking about that with Constance Fisher. She was a woman who killed a lot of her children. I think in the end it ended up being 12. She killed 6 children and then had 6 more.
I can't remember if it was 3 and 3 for 6 in total or 6 in total each time.
It was
like each.
It was a lot.
It was a lot.
It was a lot. So I think ultimately Sheila LaBar was the only one, because she killed at least 3 men 3 separate times. That was episode 4 for you guys who want to maybe go back and listen. Although I do caution you, because it was one of the very first episodes and I cannot promise the quality is any good. But it is one of our favorite cases because it has a personal touch to both of us. At this point, just because it's one of our first cases, it's personal. But I think really we haven't covered very many other female serial killers. Just female killers who killed singularly.
Yes.
Which, trust me, guys. Us women, we gotta be represented in the media and in true crime podcasts. It's fair. We gotta be. However, women serial killers are not common at all.
No, and it's so crazy how they're covered. Even this one is a historical one, and there were so many different nicknames for her, mm-hmm. and it really just kind of focused on her appearance and how beautiful she was, and she was seducing all these men. That's always what I hear when I hear people describing or talking about female serial killers, is they're like the Black Widow type and they lure people into their web, and it really takes away from the fact that they're just really terrible people.
Right.
And it also is probably really shitty for the victim and the victim's families. Like, I know this one's a historical one, anyone that's still living of these victims is probably like, my great, 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 great grandmother was one of her. It's a little disconnected because it's historical, but I don't know. The thought of my loved one being murdered and then the news taking it as like, they fell for her trap and they were seduced by her and she wore lingerie to seduce. Like, it's really crazy.
Right.
And it just, I feel like it's very dismissive. But with a historical case like this one and that aspect of it being poisoning,
yeah,
that is something that we have not done a whole lot on this podcast.
No, not at all. And typically, I mean, factually, really, throughout history, poisoning is a very common method of murder for women. That is often what they go to, at least in history. I don't know why, maybe because it's easier. But as we know with modern technology, you can really easily detect poisoning in autopsies. Cyanide, arsenic. Cyanide, you can smell. It smells like almonds. Although there are, of course, some people who don't have that gene where they can smell almonds from cyanide. But arsenic, you know, you can test for that. There's, of course, been new developments where people have learned that you can kill people with insulin and not be detected or inject air, blah, blah, blah. But it's gone to the point in technology and science where you can now detect those things. So really, people are not poisoning anyone anymore, because it's no matter what, you're gonna get caught.
Right, exactly. And that goes for anything, but especially with poisoning, it's like, hello, they're gonna do an autopsy, they're gonna do some kind of an investigation. Really, the only way these days you can get away with a crime is if the police mishandle things, which, well, as we know,
well, about that,
more common than you might think,
but it's not worth gambling.
Correct.
I would not be like, well, I'm pretty sure the police will fuck this up, so I'm going to give it a shot. Like, okay, sure, but wouldn't bank on that at all.
Don't rely on police. Don't do crime.
I think that might be your latest merch idea. Don't rely on the police. Don't do crime.
I don't know. Stay tuned, maybe.
TBD. If anyone's got any great merch ideas for that quote, please reach out to us at truecrimeny@gmail.com with your best designs. Just kidding. That all is to say, of course, today, our episode, historical, like you said, Katie, which you guys know we love. We did a historical case relatively recently. That doesn't matter. We love historical cases, and we will cover them as often as we please.
Yeah. And love as in we love to learn more about how crimes were handled back in the day. Anything historical is always so interesting.
Yeah.
It's always very New England. I feel like New England has a lot of history. We've done so many historical, typical New England back in the day cases, but crime is just so interesting on how it was reported.
Yes.
And like in the newspaper and how people were caught and
yes,
their investigation and assessment tools at the time. It's just very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. So we do. We love to learn more about these. We love to cover them and we love to talk about them.
Yeah. I personally love the process of how they used to handle crimes and crime scenes, because it's very interesting how they developed to get to where we are now, because it's so different.
Yes. And we would also like to say, before we get into the nitty gritty of the episode, that us saying that we love historical cases does not mean that we love that people are murdered or they die or there's crime or whatever.
No.
Just throwing that one out there.
We don't love any of that. What we love is talking to you people about these cases. Because you know what? If you guys know me in my personal life, I never stop talking. So that's part of the reason why I have a podcast. Katie can confirm that. Anywho, I think now would be a great time to really get right into this case, because it's been on our list for quite some time. It's really one of the, like, it's up there on the list. So it's been waiting to be told. And without further ado, today we will be covering the Derby Poisoner. All right, Katie. Let's throw it back so far into the 1800s that we are in black and white. With that, I'd like you to take out your newspaper and cite your sources for me, please.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I have information from Murderpedia, New Haven Register, ConnecticutHistory.org, Medium, an article by John Welford, Find a Grave, and Hartford Current.
Wonderful. I, too, used Murderpedia, our dearest and closest friend. I used the New York Times. I used the Connecticut Humanities Project. I used an article called The Derby Poisoner and Serial Killer by Jerry Walton. And I used the New England Historical Society. All great sources. I had, surprisingly, a fairly easy time finding information for this historical case.
Yeah, same.
I was quite thrilled. Lydia Danbury was born on Christmas Eve in 1824 in Burlington, New Jersey. Less than a year after she was born, her birth mother died and her father eventually remarried. Soon enough, Lydia had moved away from the home she shared with her father and her stepmother and her siblings and had moved into her uncle John Clegay's home in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Some sources say she did not get along with her stepmother as a child. Who among us, right? Isn't that like the classic, like you don't like your stepmother? I don't know. I don't have a stepmother. She didn't like it. So she moved in with her uncle. It was on a farm. It was great. I don't know. It was a good adjustment for her. Lydia was described as being pretty with dark hair, blue eyes, and porcelain skin. Pretty much the very basic description of any white woman in the 1800s. And truly any website you go to and look up woman from 1800s, that's going to be the description, really. Porcelain skin is always what it says. It's like these people didn't have acne or something.
They were also racist.
Racist is part of it. So Lydia, she seemed to be sought out a lot by her fellow teenagers, but she kept to herself for a little while. She was just, we don't really know a lot about her, but we know apparently that she was pretty, as they always are with their porcelain skin. One thing we do know about Lydia was that she found solace in faith, and she attended the Methodist church nearby her home with her uncle. It was here at a, quote, love feast that she met a man named Edward S. Struck. Now, Katie, I don't know anything about religion. We all know this. I don't know what Methodist is compared to Christianity, compared to Catholicism. What is a love feast?
I am so glad that you asked me that, Liz, because I was going to ask you what that was.
Okay.
I did not see that in my research.
Okay.
So I will be Googling that after this episode.
Okay, great. It did say, I saw it in more than one of my sources, that she met him at a love feast.
You know, I'm going to hazard a guess, and this might be another moment where we get a bunch of people emailing us or messaging us or whatever, saying that's totally wrong and not off base and fact check or whatever, which, like, please do. We love always learning and more information.
Yeah, of course.
Just do it nicely, please. But I'm going to hazard a guess, and I'm going to say that a love feast is an event put on by the church where single people who are of the same faith and are looking for a partner of the same faith can meet and mingle under the eyes of God and, like, meet their match.
Okay.
Probably the girls are chaperoned and a lot younger, and then maybe the guys are older.
So like a mixer, kind of? You'd say?
I want to say somewhere between a mixer and like a religious culty thing.
Okay, like Mormonism.
Yeah.
A little like.
Yes.
Okay. Methodists, I thought Methodists were more like chill.
I am not quite.
I have no idea.
We will be looking more into religion after this episode.
I thought a love feast maybe involved like a potluck. Because I heard feast, and I was like, oh, maybe it was just like a big church event where everyone was eating and spreading the word of God or something.
Oh.
Who knows? Maybe it's something not even real. Maybe it was just something made up in this article.
Maybe that one church had this one event.
And it was just called a love feast. Maybe it's literally just non-existent.
Was it on Valentine's Day?
It could have been. Who knows? Maybe it was. Either way, guys, it was at this Methodist church and during an event, perhaps involving a mixer, perhaps involving a potluck, perhaps having nothing to do with any of that, that Lydia met her first husband, Edward S. Struck. Now, Edward was a widow, and he had at least two children of his own when he met Lydia. We don't know a lot about really anything, because every source says something different about everyone's children and their numbers in their names. It's always different. So, but we do know that he had at least two children when he met Lydia and that he was a widow. However, even at the age of 16 or 17, it depends on what source you're reading, but they somewhere between 16 and 17, Lydia was not deterred and immediately jumped into the role of dutiful housewife and stepmother for Edward. She fell right for him. She was love struck, if you could say so. Get it? Because Edward struck? So funny.
And they met at a love feast.
And they let... Wow. Comedians here. Well, what we do know, potentially, is within the next 7 years, while Edward worked as a policeman in the suburbs of New York City, Lydia bore roughly six of his children. It depends on what source you read. Some sources say six, some say eight, which would seem impossible in 7 years, understandably. What we do know is that she had a lot of children in quick succession. And keep in mind, she was 17-ish when she married him. So that's a lot for a young girl, really. I'm not saying their relationship was inappropriate, but like to suddenly be a mom and a stepmom and a wife, like bam, 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 is a lot. Now, we have names of these children. It's just that like every source that you read, the ages and the order of the children are different. But essentially, they were Martha Ann, George Whitfield, Ann Eliza, Josephine, Lydia, and William. Plus or minus two or maybe. But those are the main children that we know about. In the story, as you read, some might say that one was an infant and died. Some might say that, you know, one was older and was whatever. So it's kind of hard to pinpoint which child was which. I think what we can say with assurance is that Josephine was the infant and the only child that didn't make it past infancy. That was what we saw multiple times.
So while the family was in New York City and Edward was working as a police officer, he lost his job in 1863 and he actually was fired for failing to do his job. And as he was being fired, he was labeled as a coward on the job. Like, that was an official reason for why he was fired.
Yikes.
Because he was supposed to be on duty, and he either, like, walked away or was at a bar getting a drink or just something very irresponsible. Mm. And while he was on duty and not covering his post, like he should have been, a detective was murdered.
Yikes.
So that's really not good.
And to be charged with cowardice, you know, at that time...
Oof, that sucks.
That's bad.
Edward soon fell into a deep depression, and at that point, all he really was doing was laying in bed and getting drunk when he was able to sit up out of bed. Like, he really was going through it.
Yeah.
And as opposed to taking him to a doctor or even having him committed into a psych ward, as was pretty common practice back then in the late 1800s,
sure.
Lydia took matters into her own hands, and she decided to, in her own words, quote, put him out of the way as he would never be any good.
He just never would be any good. So, way back when, in the 1800s, buying things was a lot different, and that included poison. Now, you could go to the drugstore, and when I say drugstore, I mean the drugstore as in, like, also the hardware store and also like the chemical store. And also it was just, you could buy formaldehyde where you could buy your lipstick. It was so unregulated. So people used to rub whiskey on the gums of babies or put opium in their bottles. And it was great. Everyone was calm because they were drugged out of their minds. Like everything was so common and different and nobody knew why anything was causing anyone to die. Like everything was unregulated. So it was also really super easy to buy arsenic because, well, back then it was really commonly used for killing rats. And because the whole world was kind of really unsanitary back then, they had improved some things. There was indoor plumbing kind of working its way, and people were now washing their hands and bathing a little more regularly, you know, like. It wasn't medieval times now, like people weren't pouring their poop on the street as often, but it was still relatively dirty compared to today. So people often had rat problems and mice problems, and that wasn't super abnormal, but purchasing arsenic was super common because you had rats. You killed them with arsenic. Bada bing, bada boom. So when Lydia went to the drugstore to purchase arsenic regularly, well, who cared? Because she probably had a lot of rats. She had a lot of poopy children, so I'm sure, you know, they probably just brought rats in. And that's fine. And so luckily for Lydia and her purposes, she was able to maintain large amounts of arsenic or just secretly buy these things and then get away with buying them unsuspiciously. And unfortunately for her loved ones, or you would think they were her loved ones, this would be detrimental.
Lydia lovingly made her husband some dinner of oatmeal and a hefty dose of arsenic, specifically a thimbleful. And in under an hour, Edward proceeded to have violent episodes of vomiting, diarrhea, and intense stomach cramping. After several hours, this turned into convulsions on the floor, and Edward soon passed away just hours after he had ingested the arsenic.
Agonizing. Ugh.
This all happened pretty soon after Lydia had taken out a life insurance policy on her husband. But it really didn't hit Lydia until after Edward was dead that she just murdered the breadwinner and only source of income for not just herself, but the remaining number of her children. You know, some people say that she had 8 children total. Someone said that their oldest son, John, moved out of the house years ago, and the youngest baby, Josephine, had died of a mysterious illness even before all of this.
Yeah.
So the remaining children, regardless of how many there were, it'd be great to have an exact number, but where kids were dying left, right, and center from drinking water or, like, existing.
Yeah, literally.
It was a little hard to keep track of all of the kids and how many kids and when they died and et cetera. But Lydia was looking at all of her young children, more so their hungry mouths that she had no way of feeding, because his life insurance check was not going to hit for a little while.
Right.
So as Lydia was contemplating this, she came to the conclusion that the youngest 3 children, you know, they can't work, they can't go out and beg on the streets or, like, make any kind of money. So she just kind of thought, wow, they're useless to me, which is really not the thought of a loving mother. You know, she just is looking at her kids like, you guys are a burden. You gotta go.
Yeah.
And just 6 weeks after Edward's death, Lydia poisoned the 3 youngest children, and they were all poisoned on the same day, even though one of them did not pass away until the next day. And it's like an excruciating, awful, horrible death. They're like convulsing and foaming at the mouth, and it really is brutal.
Yeah.
And we all are probably thinking, like, okay, Edward is dead.
Yeah.
Now her 3 children, who she all poisoned on the same day, drop dead.
Right.
Certainly someone must be paying attention or thinking this is really suspicious.
Absolutely.
No.
Oh.
No.
Oh.
This was kind of just brushed off as a product of the times because kids were dropping dead left, right, and center. They kind of ruled it off as consumption or mysterious illness or just one of the very generic causes of death that they used a lot back in the day.
Yeah.
Authorities had actually attempted to perform an autopsy or at the very least some kind of an investigation into Edward's death because he was not that old. It was super sudden. And they know that he had lost his job from the police force, but he was a former police officer.
Right.
So they were going to at least grant him the dignity of doing some kind of an investigation.
Sure.
Lydia wasted no time making sure that he was buried. And she also made a really big show, like a big production, out of appearing as though she was a grieving widow. So whenever authorities would knock on her door, she would, like, throw on her black veil or whatever and just be dabbing at her eyes with a handkerchief.
Right.
Like, come back another time, officer. I just can't bear to talk to you.
Yeah.
My dear Edward. Oh, Edward. My children are ailing. And
yes.
It's just not a good time. So authorities are like, oh, this poor woman, this is so unbearable. We can't even imagine. We have to give her space to grieve.
Yes.
Let her bury Edward as soon as she wants. Yeah. And they just, like, let her do her thing.
Yeah. It was insane. Like, to even question her about poisoning her husband would be atrocious. Because she was the dainty, grieving widow. She was still very young at this point. Like, under 30 or something. Like, she was young. So, it was like, How dare you? I'm a widow. Oh, you can imagine her throwing her hand to her forehead and like arching her back like, oh,
I'm feeling a bit faint. I'm going to need you to leave. Like,
and we already know she's got that porcelain skin, so she probably looked real pale. And that probably made them go, oh, boy, you know, oh, we wouldn't want a lady to fall and accidentally flash us or something, you know. But when she was, and, you know, when they were so bold to ask her, was he poisoned? Did you poison? Oh, she said, there's no way. That's impossible. How could, I would never. But if he was poisoned, she said, if he was, it was an accident because he clearly had taken the wrong medication. And then they were like, yeah, that happens to the best of us. You poor, poor woman. Please go rest. Take care of the remainder of your children before they too pass away from the same ailments. It's like, what? It's like the same thing that O.J. Simpson did. Killed his wife and the waiter and then goes on trial and he writes a book, If I Did It. It's like, yeah, you did it. You idiot. And then she's like, well, if he did, it was medication, probably. Oh.
That would be her if she were ever educated on how to write.
Yes. Right. I don't think she didn't know. No. I don't even know how she named her children. She didn't know what names were, anyway.
I can't even spell poison, let alone...
Oh, how dare you accuse me? I'm just a simple porcelain-skinned woman. It's like, come on.
And it's crazy, and she's putting on this act, and so much so, not even to authorities, but just, like, she steps outside her house, and she's, like, collapsing on the street. Like, she's so dramatic that a local doctor took notice and was like, wow, you have no way to feed your children. Mm-hmm. I'm going to offer you a job as a nurse. Like, I'll train you. You can be a nurse. You're a woman. That's the one job that women are fit for these days. And just, like, I will hire you because I feel so bad for you because you're, like, you're probably being carried into my office every 2 seconds because you're grieving so much.
Right.
And then over the next couple of months, Lydia was using her nursing skills, quote unquote, to care for her three remaining children who are also ailing and all mysteriously end up passing away. And now you guys might be thinking, like, this has to be the moment where authorities are like, okay, Lydia, what's wrong? Like, come on, let's be real. She would call a different doctor to the house every time each child passed away, and the symptoms that she would tell this doctor, like, oh, they were coughing up blood or they had the scarlet fever rash or whatever. So the doctors are writing it off like, oh, it's consumption. It's this, it's that.
Mm.
And they're like, okay, do you want me to come back to tend to your remaining children? She's like, no. And she'd call the next doctor. And so she really was like shopping around for different providers, essentially.
Yeah.
And no one really caught on. Except for Edward's brother, Lydia's ex-brother-in-law. He went to authorities and he told them that Lydia was, quote, full of black evil.
Mm.
He demanded that the bodies of his nieces and nephews be exhumed and examined, but authorities brushed him off. They're like, we're not going to put her through that trauma. That's horrible that you would ever even ask us that. This case is closed. Her children all got sick and died.
Right.
And it's also not uncommon for one of the kids or someone to bring an illness into the house. And then within a couple of weeks, all of the children be dead.
Right.
So it really is not like it's this big, mysterious, suspicious thing. Like, it's not uncommon for this to be happening.
Yeah.
On the surface level.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And, you know, people... It seemed like Lydia kept her oldest children around at first because they could work and make money. And then eventually it seemed like she just thought they were burdens too. So she just got rid of them. And then as soon as she was done with those kids, wiped her hands clean, that's it. She was like, great, I'm now a nurse, quote unquote, which is frankly insulting to those of us who are real nurses. Because, wow, just because you lost your husband doesn't mean you have the right to become a nurse just automatically.
Right. Like, do no harm. Come on, we all took an oath, Lydia.
Yeah, like, seriously. It's like, oh my God, okay. But she took this opportunity of now being free of all burdens, husband and children, to move to Connecticut, where she took a nice, sweet, Swiss, sexy nursing job in Stratford, Connecticut. And in 1867, Lydia met a very wealthy, so not sexy, Litchfield farmer named Dennis Hurlburt. Yeah, that's right. Hurlburt. Now he, too, was a widow. He was older. He lived well, owned land, was considered well-to-do by the locals, and he was wealthy. Now, listen, ladies, we all know how that can be maybe a little enticing. And listen, gentlemen, if that's you, and a woman comes to you and she's recently lost her husband and 6 to 8 children, I would be cautious, because I think she has a different motive up her sleeve. But sometimes you just cannot resist that porcelain skin. So, by 1868, the pair had, quote, fallen in love, and they got married. It took Dennis almost no time at all before he changed his will and made Lydia the heir of all of his money and land. So, I don't know what she did, but she did it. She had it all under lock and key. And Lydia was aware of the fact that there weren't that many attractive qualities in Dennis, and so she knew that their marriage may have come off in like a gold digger type situation. So she laid on the mushy and gushy like hard in public, in like even in like their backyard, if people were nearby, like could be seen watching them. She was made sure to be like, oh, Dennis. She was always, this is what neighbors said. They said she was often seen caressing and fondling her husband and always gave the appearance of happiness and contentment. And maybe she did. Maybe she was so happy and content being with a man she knew was likely to die soon. Maybe she was. Maybe she enjoyed caressing him and fondling him. Maybe. I don't see that being realistic, but maybe she liked it.
And it's so crazy because I guess Dennis had a nickname around town. People would call him Old Hurlburt. And everyone said that he was senile, which is like the olden days term for someone who likely has dementia. So he's clearly not in his right mind. Like, he's not super confused, but he's not fully of sound mind. So I don't think that she had a really hard time convincing him to write her as the sole recipient of all of his estate and money and assets and everything once he died.
Yeah.
And she also was noticing that Dennis, who, of course, is a lot older than her, is having aches and pains and various ailments that come from being old.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lydia, she's a nurse.
Mm.
You know, she's so kind.
Yeah, she's giving.
She's so caring. Mm. She just can't bear to see someone suffer.
No.
So she sent Dennis to bed with a little special supper concoction, and within under an hour, he is vomiting, and then several hours later, he is writhing and convulsing on the floor, and then passes away.
I hate the thought of dying of old age like that. Poor man.
It's really the dementia that just...
It really makes you convulsed like that.
He didn't die, though, without leaving her his $30,000 estate, which is roughly $706,300 today.
Amazing.
That's bank.
Good for her. Wait. She killed him. Not good for her.
And don't worry. She allowed herself time to grieve.
She did.
You know, a whopping 8 weeks.
Mm.
She just took to herself, living it up, raking in the dough.
Mm.
And then she struck again.
Oh. This time, you guys will never guess who her victim was. Well, Lydia, she met a man in Derby, Connecticut. His name was Horatio Nelson Sherman. He went by Nelson, largely. And you guys will never guess what had just happened in Nelson's life. His wife had died. So, just like the two husbands before, Lydia had found herself a widower. That's sad. And Nelson, he came with 4 children of his own. And we all know Lydia loved children. Now, Nelson was a very skilled local mechanic, and he was described by many to be extremely generous, even to a fault. Now, of all the husbands, I think I like him the best. He seemed like a very nice man. very kind, very loving father. He clearly loved his children very much, and he was still sad about his wife who had died. So when he met Lydia, this beautiful, beautiful nurse with porcelain skin, he was enthralled, entranced, taken aback. And he just was, he wanted her real bad.
And it's so crazy because she had actually come into Nelson's life because she applied to a housekeeping position. But within a couple months, they were married.
Yeah, like very quickly.
Like she moved into his home in Derby, Connecticut. And then within a couple months, they were married. It was in like November of 1870. She had moved into his house in Derby, Connecticut to be a housekeeper because Nelson was looking for someone who was nurturing and loving for his children. Like he wanted someone to be the housekeeper and care for the home and care for his children who he loved so much.
Sure.
He really was a great dad.
Yeah.
And within a couple months, you know, he just couldn't resist. And Lydia really would not leave him alone, especially after she moved into the home and saw that it was a very nice home and he was very wealthy.
Mm.
And he also was more age appropriate, especially in comparison to her recent past husband, Dennis, who, R. as we know, was very old.
Yes, R.I.P.
And she moved into the house in April of 1870 and they were married a couple months later.
Oh, wow. Young love. It was so soon after their marriage that Nelson's youngest child, a little boy named Frankie, became violently sick. Violently sick. He died just a few days later. And this was absolutely devastating to his father, and he was known to have increased his alcoholic intake with the death of his little boy. So sad. And it was only a month after Frankie's death that Lydia's 14-year-old stepdaughter, Ada, became sick with the flu. Yeah, the flu. You know, the kind where you get your fever and then your convulsions and you're foaming at the mouth and your eventual agonizing violent death. She too passed away very violently, just like Frankie and old Herbert and Edward Strzok and the six children before that. Weird, though, because it was the flu, so. Now Nelson was a mess. He was just a mess because he had lost two of his children. And unlike his wife, he loved his children and he would never have dreamed of killing them. And he had just also lost his wife before Lydia. So he was still, you know, like that's very sad. And even though he had found a new beautiful wife, like it was just very traumatic. And so he was very quick to turn to the bottle. And he was often known to drink his sorrows away. I mean, who among us? That's terrible. And I can see why you would turn to that option when you have all these little babies just gone beneath you. You know, it's awful. Very traumatic. And Lydia, she's very sympathetic. She's empathetic. She's a nurse. She's caring. She's sweet. She could feel her husband's misery. That's for sure. And just like she could feel the misery of the sick children, she knew she could help Nelson out of this funk. She really did. And man, did she help him all right? Because she knew just the thing that would help her husband feel better. She did. It's the same thing that helped all of her loved ones feel better.
It rhymes with marsenic.
Marsenic. That sounds okay, marsenic. No, I'm thinking of marzipan. What is marsenic? Oh, like rat poison? Oh, arsenic. Yeah.
And it would also solve the problem that Lydia found herself facing, which is when she married Nelson, her inheritance money, because it is the late 1800s, became his money.
Right.
And so to fund his drinking problem, he is taking a big chunk out of her inheritance money and he went on a week-long bender.
Yep.
He was barely home. She did not want to raise these children. She really didn't want anything to do with the remaining two children.
Mm-hmm.
And she's being left to like run this house and take care of these kids while she knows that he's out getting drunk as a skunk and blowing through all of her, I'll put this in air quotes, hard-earned money.
Mm-hmm.
So she is coming up with a solution, like two birds, one stone.
Yeah.
Save my money and help him curb his drinking problem.
Sure.
You can't have a drinking problem if you're dead.
I was going to say send him to rehab, but I guess that's not really how she does things, huh?
His go-to beverages were brandy and cider.
Mm.
So she started mixing arsenic into his brandy and cider.
Sure.
And within a few days, he was violently ill, throwing up all over the place, doubled over with stomach cramps, collapsing on the floor, convulsions, foaming at the mouth, ceased to exist.
Yeah.
This death, however, stood out.
Mm.
And it stood out especially to a local doctor named Dr. Beardsley. Great name.
Awesome name.
He quickly took notice and thought this was so suspicious. Like, yeah, he was a drinker, but he was also pretty young. And it's just, it's very untimely, even for the times.
Mm-hmm.
So he did some further examination, did a little bit of an autopsy. And sure enough, when looking at the stomach contents, the doctor found evidence of Lydia's signature cocktail, large amounts of arsenic.
Mm.
And he was like, wow, that's crazy. Arsenic. I don't know if that's, you know, something that, wait a second. Didn't Nelson's two children die very suddenly? Weren't there other people in Lydia's life who died quite suddenly? So this doctor ordered that Nelson's deceased children, as well as the body of old Dennis Hurlburt, be exhumed.
Yeah. And I bet Lydia didn't think that was going to happen, because guess what? Hadn't happened before. And well, they were exhumed. And it was very soon into their autopsies that it became clear that they were poisoned with arsenic as well. And while these bodies were being exhumed and the evidence was being collected, the police started tailing Lydia everywhere she went, following her every move, trying to catch her in the act of doing something guilty or poisony. And Lydia may have caught on to the air of suspicion in the clouds around her, so she took off to New Brunswick, New Jersey, and stuck out some time with her family. But she could not run the law forever. It was all finally catching up with her. And in June of 1871, about a month after her third husband died, Lydia Sherman was arrested for his murder. She was brought back to Connecticut to face the judge and the jury. And of course, Lydia's story was the talk of the town. It was covered in all the newspapers, and it was often the topic of conversation between the people at the bars and in their homes. She gained many nicknames, including the Wickedest Woman, America's Queen Poisoner, Woman Monster, which I think is just not really that original, and, of course, the Derby Poisoner.
When Lydia was arrested, she almost immediately claimed some kind of responsibility for Nelson's death, but she tried to play it off.
Yeah.
She was like, well, you know, he liked to put Solaritus in his alcohol, which is a baking soda-like compound that when you mix it with cider, it makes it foam.
Mm.
And a lot of people who drank cider really liked to add the Solaritus because it added like a texture and a foam and it was just fun. And she said, yes, like I made a little whoopsie daisy. I didn't mean to kill him. He was intoxicated. He wasn't reading the label, but I might have accidentally stored the Solaritus next to the bag of rat poison that I purchased for the sole purpose of that bag looking really similar to the bag of Solaritus. So even if I didn't put it in his alcohol, yes, I am responsible because I did intend for him to have that, only he did it himself. So really, it's not actually my fault.
Oh.
And they're like, yeah, okay, Lydia, like, go free. Psych. Just kidding. Of course she was arrested.
Yeah, like, come on. Would she think that would help? What was her thought process on that?
I'm just a woman.
I could never.
I can't read.
How do I know what's Solaritus and what's arsenic? I don't know what words are. Now, Lydia's trial began in April of 1872, and like you said, she maintained her innocence in a way that still kind of said, like, well, about that, you know, like, but she still wasn't like, I didn't kill him. He technically, you know, and many were questioning why she had not just simply divorced all of her husbands, as Connecticut was known to be a state that was actually pro-divorce and allowed one to do so easily and without judgment, even at this time. And others wondered how mother could kill her own children. A lot of them were saying, like, Sure, stepchildren may have been one thing, like more reasonable, but children of her own womb? It was incomprehensible to the general public. Stepchildren, okay. Own children, not okay. It's very bizarre. The reporter also largely questioned how she was never suspected of anything when so many people in all of her household had died and in such a rapid succession each time. After the 8-day trial, Lydia was found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to life at Wethersfield Prison. It is suggested that Lydia was charged with second-degree murder because it was just so obscene to charge a lady of first-degree murder, even if the evidence was all there.
She had confessed to poisoning her 3 husbands, and she confessed to poisoning 4 children, 2 of whom, she said, were Nelson's children. Like, yes, she admitted that. And then she was like, well, you know, all my children died of an ailment, but maybe 2 of them were poisoned. On June 5th, 1877, Lydia escaped from prison.
Which, honestly, like, good for her.
I didn't even know what to think when I read that. I was like, are you shitting me?
Yeah.
One of the prison guards, the prison matron, actually, was being a little careless, had her back turned, and several of Lydia's friends actually helped her escape, smuggled her to Providence, Rhode Island, and she was found with, you're never going to believe this, a wealthy man who was recently widowed.
She just was, like, right back into it. She was, like, not even, like, okay, I probably should lay low. I should probably, like, get my bearings, spend some time gathering myself, maybe find a job, go under a different name, blah, blah, blah. No, she was just like, hey, you look sad. You want a bone? Like, I don't know. Like,
she had such a type. It's so crazy. This would have been her 4th man.
Yeah. Widow. Crazy. Absolutely crazy. And you know what's so funny? She, like, there were so many opportunities for her to get caught. As she was escaping, there was, like, a prison guard who saw her, and she was wearing, like, a muslin dress or whatever. And the guard thought that she was the warden's wife. And so he was like, oh, well. Like, literally could not have cared less. Like, what? She, like, the fact that she made it out of there, like, okay, you go off, girl. But unfortunately, like you said, Katie, she was eventually found not too long after she made it out of there. So how she got caught was because of, well, she was stupid. To really sum it up, she basically had, like, told everyone her name was Mrs. Brown. She was coming from Philadelphia. You know, she made fast friends. She told, you know, this guy, oh, you know, Miss Brown, whatever. And then she came, you know, whatever, left, whatever, came back and then said, oh, coming in, checking back in for Mrs. Moore. And they were like, I thought you were Mrs. Brown. And she was like, oh, yeah. Silly old me. I must have, in my old state, I must have given the wrong name. And it was like, huh? Also, so when they called in police, they were like, you know, who are you? They had heard about Lydia's escape. And they were like, this is kind of suspicious. I read somewhere, and I thought this was very interesting, that when the police came to talk to her and be like, okay, who are you? You know, like, you gave 2 different names. They discovered in her possessions this napkin ring that had the name Lydia on it. And when they found it, they were like, what's this now? And she tried really hard to be defensive and said, it's just a napkin ring. And it just says Lydia on it, not Sherman. And they were like, we didn't, what? Sherman? We didn't say anything. And she was like, oh, fuck. And then they were like, gotcha, bitch. And they brought her back. So at the end of the day, she did end up back at Wethersfield Prison, where she was kept under a much better lock and key. Much better. As she deserved.
It's so interesting because, like we talked about at the top of the episode, where she put on this act of, oh, I'm the grieving widow and I'm collapsing in the street. And I think that she should have said, fuck marrying husbands. I gotta go live my life out on the stage. Cause she flair for the dramatic, let me tell you.
Yeah.
In prison, when she was brought back, she was known to be feeble and sickly. And she had this crayon. And I say that very loosely, not like a Crayola crayon, but more so like a pigmented stick. And They searched her prison cell, and on one occasion, they found, quote, a piece of crayon of a very bilious color, and of experimenting with it upon the white skin of different persons, it was found that a little brisk rubbing would change the color of the cuticle from a clear white to a sickly yellow. And it is now believed that the woman, as a crayon artiste, has for a long time made a complexion to suit the demands of an artificial fever complaint and make prison life endurable. AKA, she was rubbing the shit out of this crayon, this pigmented stick that was a really sickly, gross yellow color.
Yeah.
All over her face, all over her body, all over the cuticles of her nails, so that whenever someone would look at her, they're like, wow, you're jaundiced.
Yeah.
You're yellow. You are so ill. Yeah. You're in liver failure. Please rest in bed. We're not going to put you to work.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the night, she would like, roll over and go to bed and like wash her face and wake up in the morning and do it all over again.
Yeah.
Like, it was so crazy. It was so crazy. And then actually a lot of sources said that she was in liver failure because of this.
Yeah.
But it was wild because over the next couple of years when she was in prison, she was saying like, I really don't feel good. I just am exhausted all the time and I'm in a lot of pain. And
yeah.
They're like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, right. Because she had been boy who cried wolf.
Right. And then she was diagnosed with cancer in 1878 and passed away in prison on May 16th of that same year at the age of 51.
Mm. Bye. When news had spread that she had died, the newspapers concluded that her death ultimately was a good thing for society. Which, womp womp. Can you imagine having that written about you?
I know.
It's kind of sad.
Oh, my God. And even though she only confessed to 7 murders in total, like the 3 husbands, the 4 children, it's very obvious that it was at least 11,
yeah.
Right? Like with all of the 6 children in the beginning and the 2 from Nelson and then Dennis and then 2 husbands, Edward, and then this. And then a lot of people think that baby Josephine, who had died before Edward of a mysterious illness, mm-hmm. quote unquote, they thought that maybe Josephine was a little sickly, and that Lydia had killed her first.
Yeah, I think that's, given her history, I think it's probably likely.
Yeah, so definitely 11, maybe 12. One article I read said that she could be responsible for the deaths of up to 42 people. I would like to know more about that.
Yeah.
42 rats, maybe, like testing out her methods.
Yeah. I don't know about that.
But definitely 11. Definitely more than she confessed to, for sure.
Absolutely. Because she was, once she started, she was not to be stopped. She was addicted. She loved the feeling of poisoning her loved ones. It's insane. But yeah, guys, that is the story of Lydia Sherman, aka the Derby Poisoner. Another historical case for you guys. And as always, we want to know what you think. Please feel free to message us and reach out to us with your thoughts and your opinions. You can find us on Instagram at truecrimene.
All lowercase.
And you can send us an email at truecrimene@gmail.com.
We also have a website, truecrimene.com. You could go to our Contact Us page and use our handy-dandy submission tool. Send us your thoughts on this case, other cases we have covered, especially our plethora of historical cases now. You could send us your questions, comments, concerns, case suggestions based in New England, please, especially if they are historical. We love any and all cases based in New England, but there is just a special place in both of our hearts for historical cases. You can be anonymous if you so choose. You can leave your name if you so choose. And if you leave your name with any of the above methods for contacting us, you'll get a shout out at the top of the episode. Another way to get yourself a shout out is to scroll down a little further to our Buy Us a Coffee page. You can click the button that says thank you and go to our Buy Us a Coffee page where you can buy myself a coffee and Liz a non-coffee related but still caffeinated Beveragino. But we seriously, you guys do not have to spend a single cent on us. Just being here, just listening and coming along with us for the ride with the cases that we cover means so much to us, and we could not ask you to do anything more.
Absolutely. And with that, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Goodbye.